listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
When we were putting together an issue of Stanford Medicine on time and its impact on healthcare and biomedical research, I remembered an essay that neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi had written for the New York Times about his cancer and facing an uncertain future. I reached out to Paul and asked him if he would write an article for the magazine about the limits and challenges of time when one is facing death. When he turned in the piece, I was awestruck, as were my colleagues, and we didn't change a single word. And like most people who read Before I Go, I was terribly moved by its ending. It's a note to his daughter. When you come to one of the many moments in life when you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you have been and done and meant to the world, do not, I pray, discount that you filled a dying man's days with sated joy, a joy unknown to me in all my prior years, a joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rests satisfied. In this time, right now, that is an enormous thing. Those words were really breathtaking and heartbreaking and clear-eyed, and there was only one word when I read them initially, and that was wow. Today, I'll talk with Paul's wife, Stanford physician Lucy Kalanithi, about the words that Paul left behind, a new book entitled When Breath Becomes Air. In her review in the New York Times, book critic Janet Maslin said Paul Kalanithi has written a great, indelible book. Just published last week, When Breath Becomes Air is already number one in the New York Times bestsellers. Lucy Kalanithi, thank you for joining me on One to One.
My pleasure.
You know, I was sitting here thinking a moment ago that Paul sat in that chair 3 months before he died. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking the day I was driving in to do the interview with him, how do I talk to someone who's dying? And we did, and because he spoke about it so forthrightly and honestly and with humility. And I wonder, almost, you know, I was thinking about how do you and I talk, and what do we get our hands around, and what don't we touch, and what do we touch? And I want to start out, I guess, with a simple question of, since the book has come out, what's been your reaction to the response, which has been overwhelming?
It's funny that you started out by saying that this is the chair where Paul sat. I'll just say I listened actually to your interview with Paul this morning, just to hear that again. And I think there's something happening where the response to the book and even the chance to sit here with you where Paul sat is really helpful and kind of therapeutic for me, because it's a way of connecting with Paul, or sort of like today I literally heard his voice, you know, listening to your podcast, and then other people getting a sense of who Paul was or benefiting from what Paul wrote is kind of really great. And that, for the most part, that's how it's felt. And then obviously it's also been kind of really surreal to be sort of having this very personal experience of grief and bereavement, but then
a collective.
Sort of having it publicly too. But yeah, in a way, it's very helpful.
I was wondering about that, the collective. You know, the beauty of and the power of what he wrote is so enormously touching. I just look at Facebook and the response on Facebook. And the collective empathy, sympathy, sorrow, what is that? How does that feel to you?
Yeah, that's exactly the thing that's kind of really helpful. And the other thing that's helpful is, you know, Paul wrote this book about a very personal experience, but obviously it's a universal experience too, facing mortality. And he wrote it for the reader. He wrote it to bring the reader into that experience and kind of talk about bigger questions. And so seeing people respond to exactly what Paul hoped to do and sort of create a legacy in so doing, you know, that's the thing that gives you a legacy is if people respond to it and hold on to it. And to see that happening and to see what Paul dreamed of is is kind of the other great part of it. And you're exactly right. It is kind of universal and collective.
I remember when my brother was, my brother died young and he was facing death and he said, has my life been worth it? And, you know, that is sort of the existential question that someone faces when they die young. How did Paul grapple with that question of, has it been worth it? Have I done enough? Have I contributed enough?
Right. I mean, it was very disorienting and painful. And he did really need to grapple and struggle with it. The interesting thing about Paul is that, you know, maybe like many people, he'd been thinking about that question even when he wasn't sick. And the choices he made were very considered. And interestingly, he'd also been kind of interested in death as a philosophical question as a young person. He'd always thought about being a writer. And so there was this sort of confluence of factors that helped him process and record that tough experience. But I agree. And I think it's actually, even if you're older and you face illness or mortality, as we all will, I wonder whether it doesn't necessarily get easier. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you're 90 years old and you see your body betray you, I wonder whether it's not actually easier.
Does it feel odd to be his spokesperson, his conduit, his voice?
I wouldn't say odd. I actually feel like it's a real honor. I really love him. I'm really proud of him. And we really kind of went through this together and made each other brave. And I feel very, very compelled to help his book make its way into the world and then represent him the way that I hope he would want me to, you know.
How did you both keep so brave? How, knowing that the end, there was always an end in sight. It was either months or days, weeks, et cetera. How did
hopefully you? Hopefully a few years or a decade, but that was the outer end. Yeah, we were, you know, science is moving so fast in cancer that you hope that there will be a tipping point or a pivot while you're alive. But as of now, you know, metastatic cancer is terminal and we knew that. And I think some of it, how did we remain so positive or accepting or whatever the word would be? Some of it, I think, had to do with the fact that we were both doctors. We fell in love in medical school and we kind of talked about these issues as we watched our patients face them. And I think, interestingly, I sort of drew strength from my patients, too, because I'd seen so many people through very tough situations. And, you know, the whole reason that physicians have jobs is that people become ill and terrible things happen. And so I think we didn't ask why me. Paul writes that in the book. He says, well, the answer would be why not me? So I don't know. I think that it was some of that perspective and experience. And then it also was we were really in love. We had a really supportive family. I think we, in a way, this sounds really kind of weird and flippant, and I don't mean it to, but like in a way, there was nothing else we had to worry about other than the fact that Paul was dying. And what I mean by that is we had a very strong community and medical knowledge and financial resources. And it actually makes me think about families who are missing one or all of those things and sort of what our obligation is to be working on that. But I think, you know, I think it was a mixture of love and luck and experience and I don't know, Paul.
And you also, you know, in a way, you also had time to say goodbye.
Right.
Versus someone who's in an accident or someone who suddenly dies. You know, everyone feels so incomplete. You know, did I tell them? You had an opportunity to say everything. That's a freedom in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's not like either of those possibilities is great. And the flip side is, you know, in a situation where you have a terminal illness, there's this whole possibility for existential crisis that you wouldn't have if you died suddenly. And so it's really hard to even compare. For us, I am very thankful that we had that time and we had time to build, to even build our lives, like when we decided to have a baby.
How did you decide that? How, knowing that your child was not going to grow up with a father, must have presented its own set of questions, issues. How did you all go through the process of deciding that that was right?
Yeah. I think we surprised ourselves, actually. We talked about it quite early on. It had been something we'd always dreamed of doing together. And the timing actually was we had pictured that we would do it toward the end of Paul's residency. And it was a very considered decision. I think initially Paul was more sure that he wanted to do it than I was. I knew I would very, very likely be a solo parent and have all of the complication that comes with that. And we each kind of thought of the other person. Paul writes, you know, some pages about this in the book where I was particularly worried that he would find saying goodbye very painful. You know, having a child could make his death more painful. And I asked him about that. And he said, well, wouldn't it be great if it did make it more painful? And, you know, what he meant was he sort of said, life is not about avoiding suffering. It's about creating meaning. And I think that is what we felt. And then there's the issue of, like you said, Katie has a dad and it's Paul, but he's not here. So he'll mean something to her kind of in different ways throughout her life. And it's up to me. And I feel a great responsibility to help her shape that narrative and also give her freedom as she kind of builds her own relationship with the idea of Paul. And he really loved her, and he left this book in part for her.
In the intro of this, I read something that Paul, one of the piece from the magazine, that article he did for us, and then in the book where he tells, it's a note to his daughter, and he basically says, when you come to one of the many moments in your life, when you give an account of yourself, you know that passage really well. Every time I read it, it just, maybe it's being a father, maybe it's just connecting with the humanity of it, but the heartbreak of it is almost overwhelming to read that. And when she knows that, mm-hmm. when she reads that, when she feels that, to know mm-hmm. an incredible love.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that he left his legacy.
Yeah. I couldn't say it better. I feel the same way. It feels like one of my prized possessions to have and hold that paragraph, you know, and he really meant it.
Yeah.
And it captures something, too, about the time that he was ill. It was very painful time, but it was also a very meaningful, loving time, and he kind of encapsulated that sense. And exactly, it's like you describe it as like very heartbreaking, but also beautiful.
What are your days like now?
I'll say this. Since Paul died, there's not a particular routine that I've settled into. Some of that is related to the fact that I worked really hard to shepherd his book through publication. And so I've had a foot in the literary world since he died, which is very, very new to me. And then now I'm promoting the book, which obviously has its own schedule and obligations that are great and exciting. And I'm partly back at work seeing patients. And in the summer, I was back at my other job at Stanford working on healthcare value. And that's the job to which I'll return in a few months. And it's funny because when someone dies, there's not only the loss of that person, I've learned, there's also the loss of routines and, you know, other relationships. And I guess I don't mean like fraying relationships. I mean more like somebody I miss is Paul's oncologist and his nurse practitioner and this whole set of other people and the routines Paul and I had. So it's funny because I think there's a lot of, it's very disorienting to become a widow. And so when you ask what my days are like, they're still unpredictable for a lot of reasons. And I'll be building my own self and career and family with Katie going forward.
Did you ever think that you would say the word widow? I mean, when you hear it come out, you know, to look at you, you're so young. I'm a widow, you know.
No, I know. It's a heavy word and it feels weird to say it, but
I think of when someone, like I think of someone draped in black and a veil over the,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly. I think it's funny because I agree with you about the weight and sort of like moroseness of that word. But at the same time, I I kind of own that, and I think it's accurate, you know. So sometimes I say I'm Paul's wife, which actually also feels accurate at times too, but I don't shy away. It's a little bit like when people say so-and-so passed away instead of so-and-so died. I use the word died, and I use the word widow, and they're stark, sometimes shocking words, but like the situation feels stark and shocking too. Mm-hmm. So the words feel like widow. It is like that painful, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm a widow.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also use the word died. When I write to someone, I say, I'm sorry that your spouse, friend, whatever, yeah, died. Passed away seems so, you know, ethereal, so sort of like glossing it over when death, as you said.
Right, or like shrouded. I think I wouldn't begrudge somebody saying it. You know, I think it's mm-hmm. okay to say it. But yeah, for me personally, I'm okay saying died.
I was really touched by a column that you wrote for the New York Times entitled "My Marriage Didn't End When My Husband Died." You used that D word. And you wrote, "Though I can no longer comfort Paul, the other vows I made on our wedding day to love Paul, to honor and keep him, stretch well beyond death." How do those days and months, and how does grief change during that? How does it, mm-hmm. what are the contours of it, the colors of it, sort of the ups and downs of it?
Yeah. It's funny because you're sort of describing it as like a landscape, and sort of an experiential mm-hmm. landscape. And I guess the answer is, I don't know. It's really, really unpredictable. And the timeline kind of moves and fits and starts. I wrote in that essay about the experience of taking off my wedding ring, which happened 6 months after Paul died, and I went swimming with Paul's brother, Jeevan, and I took off all my jewelry to go swimming. And then I decided not to put my wedding ring back on. And it felt really sad, but right. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'll try keeping it off and I'll see how it feels. I can always put it back on. But I didn't put it back on. And yet that morning, I hadn't realized that that would be the day that I would take it off. And so it's really unpredictable.
What did it mean to you to take that off and to keep it off? And yeah. what did it feel like without having it on?
I mean, it's funny because in a practical sense, it felt physically weird. You know, I'd had it mm-hmm. on for 8 years. But then it felt, initially when Paul died, I wore it. I wasn't in a hurry to take it off. It felt comforting to keep it on. Mm-hmm. And then now I'm not wearing my wedding ring. I am wearing Paul's wedding ring on my right hand, mm-hmm. and I'm wearing my engagement ring on top of it. And I think probably at some point I'll take those off. But right now, wearing those two rings on a hand that doesn't signify anything. You know, nobody looks at mm-hmm. me and says, she's married. They think, oh, you know, mm-hmm. that could be my grandma's ring. That could be something else. But it does indicate this sort of molting, you know, and I think there's probably things you molt and don't molt. And, you know, if I remarry in the future, does it mean I don't love Paul? No, mm-hmm. I'll probably love Paul my whole life. But the trappings of marriage and the experience of marriage are not things that I have right now with Paul, despite all those feelings. So I think it's sort of a coming to terms with that. And there's physical, the ring is like a physical sign of that.
How do you, at this point, Katie is a year?
18 months,
18
yeah.
months, so more than a year. How do you connect her with her dad now, day to day?
I mean, in my mind, in a lot of ways, there's pictures of Paul in our house. And then I sing her this bedtime song that says, Mommy loves Katie, Daddy loves Katie, that is a little song my mom used to sing to me. And I didn't take out the words Daddy loves Katie. And I don't know if I will. I think I like that stretching forward. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's funny because she doesn't, I look at her sometimes playing or talking or, you know, at the park. And I think she doesn't know anything that's happening. Like, she loved Paul. She was very connected to Paul, and you could tell by looking at them. But she now, Paul's gone, and it didn't disrupt her lives in a way it disrupted ours. And meanwhile, she also doesn't know Paul wrote this book, and that there's a bit of a media storm around it. And so she'll learn all these things later. But sometimes it's funny because she's so central to all of it and to my life, but she, in a way, doesn't know any of it yet.
I mean, the, just as you're saying that, I'm thinking of this universe out there that is existing right now that she has no knowledge of,
sure.
and that it's the dichotomy between mm-hmm. that just the and you knowing that, knowing mm-hmm. that there's this, you know, book that is now number one on the New York Times, mm-hmm. you know, bestseller list, and mm-hmm. it's about your daddy, Katie,
yeah.
and you don't know about that. It hasn't entered into your life yet. Your life is
exactly.
filled with
yeah.
other things and other moments.
Wild, yeah.
How did you balance during the period of time of finding out the diagnosis and Paul had lung cancer and Paul never smoked?
Mm-hmm.
How did you balance hope, optimism, enthusiasm, you know, denial, fear? How do those jumble of emotions, is there a way to handle, to deal, to separate those?
Yeah. We shared them, which was helpful for us.
You talked about them.
Yeah. And he wrote about them. I was reading the book as he was writing it.
Mm-hmm.
So the writing was actually a piece of it. Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do with tolerating discomfort. You know, uncertainty is very uncomfortable to tolerate. Obviously, having a terminal illness or watching somebody become ill and die is very painful. So some of it is just about tolerating discomfort, you know, which is easier to do some days and other days really, really hard.
And, you know, I heard you in an interview you did elsewhere that almost like when Paul died, it was the right time. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Oh, yeah. I think it's on the Katie Couric interview.
Yeah.
I met Katie Couric and she asked, were you ready? And I said, yeah, I was ready. I think that's what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. How do you become ready? What is ready mean?
Yeah, good question. Because I think at the same time you're not ready. It's a good question. I think I understood that Paul's illness was terminal and that he would die, and I think. There's actually a study that says of patients with terminal cancer, a significant proportion don't know or understand that their cancer is not curable. And I think that's not even necessarily to do with denial. It can be due to, you know, not getting the correct information in a medical setting or a whole variety of factors, I think. And I don't even think it's anybody's fault necessarily, but I think it's a very tough thing to handle. I think almost luckily for me and Paul, we had real knowledge as doctors and as a couple what was happening. And so I was able to grapple with it emotionally before it happened. And so I think that's partly what I mean by what I meant when I said I was ready. And I think another piece is he was very ill, very ill. And it was very important for him to be lucid and have meaningful time, and that was slipping away. And so too, you know, I don't know quite how to answer. I mean, I think it's at the same time you just aren't ready because it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting word to use.
And you crawled, you crawled in the bed with him.
Yeah.
Right before he died.
That's right.
And those last moments, can you describe those last moments of knowing this?
Yeah.
You know, it's
wow,
like
yeah.
the day before you, I remember the night before my wife and I had our first child. I'm thinking, tonight, no baby, tomorrow,
oh,
baby.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, and
right.
those thresholds you cross.
Oh, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
And how did you,
yeah.
what was that threshold like?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think, I mean, there was a practical piece of it, which was, it was foremost in my mind to make sure that he was comfortable. So I was looking at him and talking to our family and talking to the nurse and like very much trying to make sure he was comfortable. And I think he was. And then he, before he died for a while, he was sort of unconscious. And that was really interesting because, it's interesting. I haven't actually reflected on those hours in this exact way, like as I'm doing right now talking to you. I really did have the feeling of And I write about this in the epilogue to the book. Like, we've been in so many beds together. Mm-hmm. We've been in our bed for years together. And now we're in this bed, and this is the last time that I'll be in a bed with him. And this is his body. And, you know, this is, he's so real and close to me and, like, warm and all that. I hope this doesn't sound too morbid to be talking about, but It felt really intimate. And at the same time, I knew that it was about to disappear. And it was almost impossible to hold in my mind and, like, almost impossible to describe now, although at a distance I can describe that was the situation. It was like time went very slowly that day once I knew Paul was dying, and that was probably a good thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in the piece for the Times that you go up to his graveside mm-hmm. in the mountains, Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. and that you lie on top of the grave. Mm-hmm. What do you get from that? How close do you feel to him? And you take your daughter up there and she plays and, you know, she's living a joyous life. And what's that like for you to go there?
Yeah. I only lay on the grave that one time that I wrote about in the New York Times essay. Usually we're sitting or sometimes even standing or, like, walking nearby. It's a really beautiful spot. And it actually feels not only sad to be there, it feels like really wonderful.
Is it a cemetery?
It's a cemetery, yeah. Yeah, and it's actually looking, where Paul is, it's kind of looking west toward the ocean, so you can see the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. It's really beautiful place to be. Like, frankly, I think about how Paul would have liked sitting there, you know, like drinking a beer and looking at the clouds or the sunset. So it's a nice place to be anyway, and then it's a very nice place to remember Paul and reflect on Paul in a place where that suits him. You know, I think that's a real blessing to have a physical place to go that feels like it suits him.
What's the conversation that you hope the book stimulates? What do you hope that people gather around tables, dinner tables, coffee tables, book clubs? What do you want people to really consider?
Yeah. In short, I think the thing that Paul wanted them to consider and that I see them considering when I'm reading book reviews and things like that, which is sort of this big question about how do we find meaning in our lives. And then I think there's also, you know, and the second thing Paul wanted people to do was or that he wanted to be doing and express was sort of getting his head around mortality, sort of philosophically, but then also in a really personal sense. I think that's a hard thing to do. And then I think there's this whole other piece, which was, since Paul and I are both doctors and I think a lot about healthcare value, there's a conversation that it could stimulate or be part of. And that's, you know, what Atul Gawande is also doing in his book, Being Mortal, where he's talking about, you know, how do we as a society in healthcare and in medicine think about how to be providing medical care that meets people's deepest values in how they live and die. And so I think being part of that conversation, and it's a conversation in which I'm involved too as a physician, is exciting for me to see. It's a spark in that conversation.
How will this change the way you interact with patients? How will this experience change the way that you talk to your patients? What's the impact there?
It changes and it doesn't change things. My career, I'm a general internist. And then, so I see patients, and then I also work at a research institute at Stanford, the Clinical Excellence Research Center, that thinks about healthcare value. And so those big questions of sort of what are we getting for our money and our effort in healthcare, and are we doing what we mean to do as we take care of each other, and are we missing opportunities or spending our money wisely too. I think this experience with Paul and Paul's illness really solidifies and deepens some of what I understood about the human piece of healthcare and the way in which our values is part of that question about value in healthcare.
What do you want Katie to know about her dad? What do you really want to impress upon her? As she grows and This man becomes mythical and sort of larger than life in some respects. And
yeah. I mean, it's interesting. That's interesting because, you know, when Paul was alive, he was not a well-known writer. And, you know, looking back for her, it appears that he's a well-known writer, you know.
Yeah,
so that's interesting.
Right.
The main thing is that he really loved her, really loved her and was transformed by her. And then the other piece is, you know, there's something he talks about in the book about striving and how he himself felt like it was really important to strive to do the right thing and to be a good person and to try hard. And so insofar as you deliver that message to your children as you help them grow up into who they are, I think that's something he would have done as a parent. And it kind of leaps out of the pages. And that's I think, something I want to bring to her from him and from me, too.
And the other thing is, I wonder what you want to tell people who are grappling with end of life in their own families.
Yeah.
What are the lessons that you learned that you would love to sit down with someone and say, don't forget this or don't miss this?
Yeah. It's different for everybody, you know. It's like I'm sort of hesitant to give universal advice, just because I think I don't want to be presumptuous, but, I do think that, there's something to be said for the fact that, you know, death will happen to everybody. And, in a way, death at this point in history is sort of being treated as a medical problem. And we have all this technology and we're not quite sure when to stop using it. And I think there is something to be, you know, there's a lot of care that happens at the end of life, whether it's chemo or whether it's, you know, ventilators in an ICU or whatever it might be, where it could actually be diminishing people's quality of life or even length of life or ability to enjoy and make meaning out of their lives. So I think it's a big question for us in U.S. healthcare right now to be having these conversations about what is our care getting us. And I think that question is something that families and physicians are all challenged by and faced with. And so, you know, how to be realistic while being hopeful and how to, you know, choose care that, you know, while you wish you didn't have to deal with illness and death, if you do, how do you make it the best and most meaningful you can, you know? I think you know what I'm saying. It's probably hard without a specific story, but I guess that's the main thing I would say.
When Breath Becomes Air, who came up with the title?
So that's Paul's title. It comes from, and this is kind of an epigraph to the book too, it comes from this little short poem by Fulk Greville, who is I think 15th century poet. And it's this little poem that starts out by saying, "You that seek what life is in death, now find it air that once was breath." You know, and that obviously kind of describes the moment of dying when what was your breath is now just air. And it's really intense, beautiful title. And
Very intense.
It's amazing, right? And Paul, we were lying in bed where Paul was doing a lot of writing when he wasn't feeling well. And he said, "I think I came up with the title for my book." And he said, "What about when breath becomes air?" You know, it just sort of strikes you with a force. Mm-hmm. So it's not word for word from that poem, but it's obviously sort of crafted from that poem. And that poem is in a little poetry collection put together by Robert Pinsky that has all these really amazing poems called Singing School. And Paul sort of carried it around with him for the whole last year of his life. It was his computer that he was writing on and this little poetry anthology. And he liked a lot of the poems in there.
Lucy Kalanithi, thank you for joining me in One to One. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.